No surprise here, but you know I gotta have my devices when I travel. I would be lost without my smartphone. I use it for directions, to find things to do, and most importantly, where to eat. I rely on it as a digital music player to enhance my experience as I explore a new place. Oh, and sometimes I even use it to make calls and stuff. That's the kind of traveler I am. And if you travel, you know what kind you are, too. That's why you go with the Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card. If you travel, you know. Working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On the network that covers more roads than any other carrier, take your work on the road and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business and evolving your passions. They push what technology can do so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to now.
When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Tech Stuff, a production from iHeartRadio.
Hey there, and welcome to Tech Stuff. I'm your host, Jonathan Strickland. I'm an executive producer with iHeartRadio, and I love all things tech. It is a Friday, and it's time for a Tech Stuff Classic episode. This episode originally published August 6th, 2014, and it's one about an important person in tech, an important person who, at least at the time, not a lot of people outside of certain tech spheres really knew a lot about him. So this episode is titled, Who Was Claude Shannon?
The father of information theory.
Right. Also known as the father of the electronic communication age. And his full name, Claude Elwood Shannon, very important person. He's been compared to, some pretty impressive bigwigs.
Some decently big people, Einstein.
Yeah, Einstein being one of them. And you might say, well, Einstein, like, Einstein's name has become synonymous with just the concept of genius, like to the point where we use it in phrases where we're being, a little condescending,
cheeky.
Yeah, way to go, Einstein, that kind of thing. But as you'll see when we go through this episode and explain what Claude Shannon did and his contributions to technology, as well as just kind of his wacky personality, you'll really kind of see how that applies. So, exactly who was he, and what did he do? When was this guy born?
He was born in 1916 in Petoskey, Michigan.
Yeah. Yep. His father was a probate judge, and his mother was a high school principal.
He also did have some mildly famous family. A very distant cousin of his kind of made a name for himself.
Yeah, for killing an elephant. With electricity.
Thomas Edison.
He did a few other things, too.
Sorry.
Yeah, that's the requisite booing from the internet. Thomas Edison obviously did many, many important things, some of them not remotely involving putting an animal to death with electricity.
Yeah. Most of them, in fact, I would say.
The large majority of which. So
kill an elephant once.
Yeah, I know. It just sticks with you, right? Well, as a boy, Claude Shannon became interested in electronics and began experimenting with different stuff. He was just curious about how things work and how to build them himself. He built a working model of an airplane. Pretty impressive. Think he was born in 1916. You didn't have airplanes for very long.
They were pretty new.
Yeah, they were brand new back in the early 20th century. And he also reportedly made a working telegraph system that he set up between his bedroom and a friend's bedroom. His friend lived half a mile away.
And it was all made out of fencing wire.
Yeah, so he could...
Well, the
wire itself. Right. Yeah, he could actually end up sending messages to his friend half a mile away.
He was also really into radio circuits and built a radio-controlled model boat.
Yeah, so very much interested.
Stuff like that, yeah.
Yeah, this is the growing world of radio technology and the growing world of communications technology. So he was interested in it as a kid. Now, a little bit later on, when he was a teenager, he got work as a basic mechanic in a drugstore, running a fix-it shop in a drugstore, because that was like the center of town.
Yeah, back when drugstores were, sure.
Yeah, where you go and get your chocolate malt and your fan fixed. You know, it's a one-stop shop. He attended Ann Arbor College, where he studied mathematics and electrical engineering. He graduated Ann Arbor College in 1936 and then went on to enroll in graduate level study at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology.
And he decided upon MIT because he saw this work study ad, pinned onto a physical bulletin board on his college campus that was advertising for someone interested in working on Vannevar Bush's differential analyzer, which was an analog computer that used these physical mechanical connections to make calculations.
Right.
The deal here was that he would spend half his time working towards his degree and the other half in the lab with Bush, who was then MIT's vice president and also their dean of engineering. So this was kind of sort of a big deal. And this machine was huge. It was the system of gears and pulleys and rods that calculated with an entire range of values that were based on the physical rotation of the rods. And you could program it by physically rearranging all of these mechanical bits to correspond with different equations. The control circuit, I mean, this is how early this was in computing technology. The control circuit itself was a system of some 100 electromagnetic switches.
Yeah. This is a kind of the evolution of what Charles Babbage created way back
right.
in the day, the difference mm-hmm. engine. So we've done the Tech Stuff's done episodes about Anna Lovelace, who was the first computer programmer. She kind of saw that computers could be things that could do more than just crunch numbers.
They could analyze any kind of data.
Yeah, they could represent stuff that isn't numbers as numbers, so that she had this brilliant idea of, oh, a computer might be able to represent something like a piece of music and be able to create or, you know, replicate it in some way years and years ahead of her time. And the computers of those days were these giant analog actual
machines.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sometimes man powered, sometimes they had this electromechanical element to it. So we're predating the time of the electronic computer at this point. So, as Claude Shannon began to work on this machine, you know, now that he had enrolled with MIT, he noticed something interesting. He saw that the switches corresponded with a concept he had started on studying first as an undergraduate and now was really focusing on, which was symbolic logic. Now, I took symbolic logic in college.
Yeah.
I loved it because the basic idea of symbolic logic is you reduce logical statements to mathematical statements.
Actually, I took a similar class. It was basically the least mathematical math class I could get away with as an English major.
Well, the neat thing about it is that if you could prove that it mathematically made sense, then
right.
you could say that the statement is true.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
And if it doesn't,
logic based, it's great.
Yeah, exactly. So you could start to listen to your friends argue and sketch it out
and be really
equation.
Annoying.
And then you say, look, here's where you went wrong. But at any rate, while he was at MIT, he started really studying the work of a thinker named George Boole, who was from the 19th century. And back in 1854, George Boole published an investigation of the laws of thought on which are founded the mathematical theories of logic and probabilities.
Sometimes known as the laws of thought.
Yeah, we usually shorten that to
yeah.
just laws of thought. So this discussion about the mathematical theories of logic had Boole using algebraic equations to represent logical forms and syllogisms, which is exactly what, you know, I experienced when I was in college. In this work, he also said that the only idempotent numbers, which are numbers that can be put through a certain operation multiple times without changing the result, are 0 and 1. For example, 1 times 1 equals 1. And no matter how many times you multiply
1 by 1, it will always be 1.
Right. So if you take the product of that equation and then multiply it by itself, you still stay with 1. Same thing with 0, although also with 0 you can add and subtract and still end up with 0. So 0, 0, 0, 0. So Boole used 0 and 1 for the values of the symbols in his algebraic logic. He said an argument held in logic if, when reduced to an algebraic equation, it held in common algebra with the 0, 1 restriction of the possible interpretations of the symbols. Meaning that if you could replace the symbols with a 0 or a 1 and it still made sense, it still worked, then it held true. So Claude Shannon looked at this and he was thinking, this is a really cool idea. I love this approach to logic. And hey, you know, a switch has two positions.
On and off.
So
it's sort of like a 1 and 0.
Yeah. I mean, what if we were to, you know, kind of play with that whole switch process? And that became something that would percolated in the back of his head for a while.
Yeah.
In fact, it percolated so long that people suspect that he had fully formed this whole idea of applying Boolean logic to electronic devices for years before writing it down. And once he wrote it out and presented it, well, we'll get there.
We'll get there. I also do want to note that around this time, Shannon became interested in juggling. I think originally for like physical mathematical purposes, he started showing up at the MIT Juggling Club.
And Juggling Club. I see what you did there.
And asking some of its members if he could like measure their juggling and thereby sort of got involved with them. And
yeah.
And this would be a lifelong interest, as we will get into a little bit later on.
A little bit of trivia. A certain podcaster by the name of Jonathan Strickland was a founding member of the University of Georgia Juggling Club.
Yeah.
So that's the only thing I really share in common with Claude Shannon. I loved symbolic logic and I enjoy juggling. There the comparison ends. For he was far more intelligent than I can ever hope to aspire. But
yes, yes.
Yeah, you have to agree.
Sorry.
I mean, no, it's
sorry,
fine.
Man.
It's fine. I have come to grips with it. I'm okay. If you told me, hey, Jonathan, you're never going to be as smart as, say, Claude Shannon or Albert Einstein, it's a, you know,
yeah, all right.
Most people won't be.
That's
so.
Fair, I guess.
1938, Claude Shannon writes a thesis applying Boole's approach to circuitry by equating the 0-1 restriction as the off and on positions of a switch within a circuit. He was 22 years old. This had never been done. This
yeah,
had never
this was
been
the
done.
First time anyone had ever said this, certainly out loud, and other thinkers have said that it would have taken decades for anyone else to have come to this kind of conclusion.
Right. We could have been sort of groping around with other approaches for years before someone had come up with this particular
version.
Solution,
yeah.
And not only did he come up with this idea, but the way he presented it in his thesis, it was very elegant. And he would expand upon it a little bit later to the point where people said, this is why he gets compared to Einstein. It's like Einstein saying, not just, I figured out this one component to how the universe works.
But being able to express it elegantly.
And have a whole picture, right? Like,
yeah.
it's not just a fact. It's a whole host of facts that all support one another. And it's like, they say, it's like you come up with a fundamental theory of science and unfold it all at once.
Just unpack it.
It's just phenomenal.
Neatly for everyone. Yeah.
So his thesis also laid out how logical functions such as and, or, and not could be implemented within a physical circuit. So building of logic gates. Now keep in mind, this is all in a hypothetical / theoretical approach.
Right. It's not like he wasn't building this mechanically or
electronically, yeah.
As the case may be. Right?
Exactly. Yeah. He was laying out how this could be possible, not actually building them himself. 1940, Claude Shannon leaves MIT after earning a doctorate in mathematics to teach for 1 year at Princeton. And here's a story that has a couple of different, has some alternate endings.
Yes.
We will present you with the two that we know of. But the story goes that he was teaching at Princeton, and while he was teaching a class, he was holding a lecture, Albert Einstein himself opened the door and stepped inside. And Claude Shannon kept going on with the lecture, but obviously was very much impressed with the fact that this genius has walked into his classroom. He sees Einstein bend over and whisper something to one of the students in the back. He sees that the student replies, and then he sees that Einstein quietly leaves the room. He continues on with his lecture. At the end of the lecture, he holds the student back and, with great anticipation, asks the student, "What did this brilliant man have to say about my lecture?" And my version of the story was that Einstein had very quietly asked the student, "Where are they currently serving tea?"
I've heard that he asked where the men's room was.
So it may be there's, "Where are they currently allowing you to pee?" Could possibly been. At any rate, apparently that became one of Claude Shannon's favorite stories. He would love to tell the story about how Albert Einstein walked into his classroom and asked something completely not connected with what he had to say. And that made him, like, just tickled
giddy.
Him. It tickled him.
Oh,
yeah.
Sure.
And I thought, well, that also tells you a lot about his personality, that he did not take himself
seriously.
Very seriously. Yeah.
Yes.
In 1941, he joined a company famous for its research and development, Bell Telephone Labs. And his work mostly focused on things that had to do with the war effort. And it's 1941, it's World War II. And it included anti-aircraft devices that could calculate and target counter missiles.
Which came pretty seriously in handy during the German blitz on England.
Yeah. It turns out if your enemy is blasting you with missiles, counter missiles are a high priority. He also got to work in cryptography. So here's something where he's got a connection with people like Alan Turing, who was working on cracking the Enigma machine back over in England. Claude Shannon was designing devices used by Allied powers to send messages back and forth. So he was looking at keeping Allied messages safe rather than cracking German messages,
right,
or Axis power messages. He later wrote a paper about communication theory of secrecy systems, which,
According to MIT, is generally credited with transforming cryptography from an art to a science. It was a mathematical proof that an encryption scheme called the one-time pad or the Vernum cipher is unbreakable.
Yes.
And it's that cipher is the basic idea of encoding a message with a random series of digits, a key, as we have talked about on the show before, which both parties communicating have a copy of. But, you know, this is a very simple concept in cryptography, but having the mathematical proof that it is in fact unbreakable if the system is
preserved
closed,
properly, yes,
then that's really awesome.
And when we talked about the Enigma machine, that was one of those systems that could have been unbreakable had people actually been able to follow the rules properly. But because there were two things that really fell apart for the Enigma machine, and I know this is a bit of a tangent, but it relates to this.
Yeah.
Those two things were, one, the Enigma machine was designed so that no matter what, the letter you pressed would never light up as the same letter would never light up as the letter that you had pressed.
Right.
So knowing that meant that you could remove one variable from all the possible outcomes. Secondly, people were not as careful with their log books, with their code books as they needed to be.
Right.
And that led to the code being broken. But everyone seems to agree that had the Axis powers been incredibly careful, then that would have been an unbreakable code. Of course, of war, you can't really.
Oh, sure. And human error being what it is.
Yeah. I mean, it's that's the difference between the ideal and reality. Meanwhile, Claude Shannon began to develop theories on how to apply his ideas about Boolean logic and circuitry to telephone switching lines. We have more episode to go, but first, let's take a quick break. No surprise here, but you know I gotta have my devices when I travel. I can't fly without my portable chargers and noise-canceling headphones keeping me immersed, and I'd be lost without my smartphone. In a new place, it's my connection to the familiar. I rely on it to get directions around town, I use my smartphone to look up things to do, or, most importantly, where to eat. In countries where I don't speak the language, my phone becomes a universal translator. And heck, it can double as a digital camera, giving me the opportunity to snap unforgettable pictures of the sights that inspire me and fill me with joy. That's the kind of traveler I am.
And if you travel, you know what kind you are too. That's why you go with the Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card. If you travel, you know.
Working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On the network that covers more roads than any other carrier, take your work on the road and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business and evolving your passions. They push what technology can do so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to now.
When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There is still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more, while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
In 1947, something else not involving Claude Shannon happened at Bell Labs. The development of the transistor. Now, the transistor was a huge breakthrough. It meant that the world of electronics could move away from things like vacuum tubes and allow this other device to take its place, essentially, which ultimately led to the miniaturization of electronics.
But it wouldn't be until Claude Shannon published his concepts about information theory that would let that be a functional item in the way that it became.
Yeah, yeah. It was really this idea of digitizing information that Shannon had that made this a practical device beyond just, especially that early transistor. It's enormous if you ever see a picture of it. I mean, compared to, if you think that billions of transistors can now fit on a microprocessor chip, and then you look at the first one, it's enormous difference, obviously. Now, this idea of digitizing information was pretty much what would allow the transistor to become useful. And also it's what would lead to things like encoding information onto storage media like a compact disc.
Right.
This is what would make not just processing data possible, but storing
saving.
It. Yeah.
Right. It's kind of a really beautiful coincidence that both of these technologies were being developed at Bell Labs within a year of each other, as it turns out, because in 1948, that is when Claude Shannon actually published his paper, Mathematical Theory of Communication.
Yes. And that's available in PDF form. We'll share the link because you can actually read his paper on information theory. And this is the one that I said earlier that, you know, people who were information theory experts, they say like this is like Einstein coming out with the theories of relativity. This idea of a complete picture, not just an idea, but a complete picture of an approach that laid the groundwork for digitizing information so it can be transmitted and stored. Now, again, he was a theorist.
He did not build this. He explained how it is mathematically possible.
Right. And so it left it up to engineers and computer scientists to figure out, okay, if this is theoretically possible, how do we make it real?
Right.
What do we do to actually put this stuff into reality and have it work for us? Now, 1948 was when it was published, but there are people who have looked into Claude Shannon's life who say that he may have had this fully formed as early as 1943, and he thought that it was a really cool idea, but just didn't think, no one else is going to care about this.
I would argue, I mean, from what I've read, it sounded to me more like he kind of had it brewing and just didn't want to present it until it was done.
He did seem like the kind of person who he wanted to make sure that he had as complete a picture of an idea as possible before presenting it to anyone else. He did not want to have the experience of coming forward with just half an idea.
Right.
He's kind of a perfectionist in that sense.
Mm-hmm.
And it really is a challenge to explain just to an average person exactly how important this theory was. But, you know, in a practical sense, at the time that he was coming up with this, it was necessary to create a better telephone system. So in the old analog telephone system, you've got some pretty big limitations, some barriers you got to get across.
Due to signal loss or noise, an analog telephone signal gets weaker the longer that the telephone line it's traveling along is.
Yeah, so in order to get around that, engineers would place amplifiers along a telephone line to boost the signal. So you get a weak signal coming in, it goes through the amplifier, the signal's boosted, it's stronger going out, but...
Unfortunately, along with the signal that you want to get boosted, all of the noise that's on the line also gets boosted. So eventually you run out. I mean, just the noise takes over.
Yeah, you lose the signal in the noise. So that would be, you know, if you've ever... heard like one of those telephone conversations that goes on in an old movie where it's just like all you hear is crackling.
Static, yeah.
Just imagine that if you're far enough away that all you would get was the static. You would not get any voice at all. So the interesting thing was that by switching from analog signals to digital signals, they didn't have to worry about this signal boosting problem. Instead of a continuous signal like a sine wave, which is, you know, an acoustic wave is what you would get with an analog telephone line. Digital signals are sent in a series of bits, and a bit is either a zero or a one. That's all based off of Claude Shannon's application of Boolean algebra to electronics, and it worked. So you could do this with telephones, which was great, but it meant you could also do it with just about any other kind of information transfer. From radio to telegraph, telephones, everything. And again, this was one of those things that could not immediately be implemented. The engineers had to build the technology to support it.
Right.
But once they did, they realized we can build out a nationwide telephone, even a global telephone system that doesn't require amplifiers every X number of miles because you're never going to lose that signal clarity.
Right. Like hypothetically, you can do this with literally zero loss in quality, so long as you don't mind taking the necessary amount of time for each bit to be transferred. Really,
right.
The transfer speed is the only cap that you're working with at this juncture.
Exactly. And Claude Shannon, he kind of came up with that too. He said, if we have infinite amount of time, you'll have zero signal loss.
Mm-hmm.
But that any medium of transmission is going to have ultimately a cap of how much data it can carry at any given within a given amount
system,
of time.
Sure.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So it was interesting because that was one of those things that ended up becoming a challenge to engineers. He said, look, for whatever medium you choose, it's specific to each medium, you're going to have this limit that you're going to hit and you can't go beyond it. And the engineer said, all right, we agree. There's no way we can go beyond that limit. So what our goal is to get as close to that limit as we possibly can.
And this also led into some really interesting side concepts about digital compression and error fixing.
Exactly. Yeah. You had to, you could end up compressing data into smaller data packages, which helps you get around that bandwidth cap.
Mm-hmm.
But in order to do that, you also have to have that error correction software, those algorithms that are able to detect and fix any errors that come across while you're transmitting this information. These were all laid out by his ideas.
Yeah, and that error correction concept also ties back into the idea that, if you scratch a CD, it can still be read.
Yeah. Yeah, because you have these extra bits that are built into the data itself. These bits that otherwise would seem superfluous. They're not necessary for you to have the full message, but those extra bits actually allow some redundancy. So if there is some damage to the physical medium, you can still end up using it. And it's not like you get a smudge on your disk and now you can't use it.
Right. So the concept of a disk also being new, because that was something that he laid out in here, saying that this is a method for possible storage, not just transmission,
right,
but also storage.
Yeah. So big ideas. At any rate, moving on with his life, I mean, he's already gotten to the point where he's laid out everything that's going to lead to things like JPEGs, MP3s, zip files, data transmission across cable, across telephone lines. All of this stuff is possible because of the ideas he came up with. His life continues on, and in 1949, he marries Mary Elizabeth Moore.
Betty.
She was a numerical analyst at Bell Labs.
And they would go on to have two children together.
And he also, during his time off from changing the world, decided to build a simple computer to play chess. And he wrote a paper about programming computers and computer chess algorithms. A lot of computer, like chess playing computers, are still based upon the foundations that he laid out while he was working on this. You find that Claude Shannon in his spare time often did things that, that most of us would be like, well, you could have a full-time job doing that. He's like, no, I just want to do that.
On the side.
I'm
interested. Whatever.
You know.
Yeah.
But I like to keep my hand in. Around that time, engineers at Bell Labs, that time being 1949, began to actually create the technology that implemented Shannon's ideas. And they built something called a regenerative repeater. And the idea was that a bit could be regenerated perfectly and repeatedly as long as the bits weren't, quote unquote, too small. So as long as the messages weren't too small, they could consistently regenerate a message. And that would mean that you would, again, have no signal loss. You wouldn't lose any data in the process because you could just as quickly as it was coming into the regenerative repeater, it would send out a copy, the same data message, back out again.
Mm-hmm. Also around this time, as the engineers at Bell Labs were creating that physical technology to incorporate Shannon's ideas, he started to introduce the idea of bandwidth limits.
Yeah, this is what I was talking about when he said, it doesn't matter what medium you're using, eventually you're going to hit that capacity. And eventually, they started calling this the Shannon capacity or Shannon limit. So it was, again, a very important idea that ended up being playing a huge role in the telecommunications industry, as well as just electronics and computing in general. So this is what gives engineers that goal. This is where they want to hit as close to that number as they possibly can to maximize the amount of data they can shove through any particular medium mm-hmm. at top speed. So, you know, we often talk about data transmission speeds, but speed is really kind of a deceptive term, because it's not just how fast something gets from point A to point B. Usually we're talking about speeds that are approaching the speed of light.
Yeah.
That's really fast. What we're really concerned with is throughput, which is the amount of data that can travel at that speed to get from point A to point B. Because if you're dividing that data up into lots of bits, like a long string, yes, each individual bit is moving at the speed of light, but you still got to get that whole string through.
It's the, you know, getting the caboose through at the end.
It's the idea of if we hear that there's pizza in the kitchen and we're all invited to go and eat it, then the problem isn't that we have a bunch of slow people on staff. We're all very, very fast. The problem is the door is only so wide, and eventually four or five of us will all just try and cram through it at the same time. So that's the difference between just speed and throughput. Now,
except ones and zeros don't usually elbow you in the face.
That's true, but we have no such restriction, as we have demonstrated upon multiple occasions. Now, at this time, engineers were also trying to find on ways to take on other elements of this theory, like the compression and redundancy ideas, and build working devices and algorithms that turned that theory into reality, actually making products that could take advantage of the ideas that Shannon had produced. And
meanwhile, Shannon received a very special present, Christmas of 1949, from his wife this year, a unicycle.
Yeah.
And stories say that he frequently rode through the halls of Bell Labs at night on this unicycle while juggling.
He is my hero.
Because why not?
Now, see, if my wife gave me a unicycle for Christmas, I would imagine she was plotting my demise. And perhaps had taken out yet another life insurance policy on me. Because she knows my lack of balance, but I have nothing but respect for someone who is transforming information theory while riding a unicycle and juggling.
Yeah.
So,
because meanwhile, he was looking into machine intelligence and memory.
Yeah, he was really branching out. You know, he was very much interested in exploring all these different ideas.
Time for us to take another break, but we will be right back. No surprise here, but you know I gotta have my devices when I travel. I can't fly without my portable chargers and noise-canceling headphones keeping me immersed, and I'd be lost without my smartphone. In a new place, it's my connection to the familiar. I rely on it to get directions around town, I use my smartphone to look up things to do, or, most importantly, where to eat. In countries where I don't speak the language, my phone becomes a universal translator. And heck, it can double as a digital camera, giving me the opportunity to snap unforgettable pictures of the sights that inspire me and fill me with joy. That's the kind of traveler I am. And if you travel, you know what kind you are too. That's why you go with the Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card. If you travel, you know.
Working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On the network that covers more roads than any other carrier, take your work on the road and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business and evolving your passions. They push what technology can do, so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to now.
When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There is still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more, while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Now, by 1956, he decides to leave Bell Labs, though he continues on as a consultant, and he goes back to MIT to teach. He also wrote a paper. It was called The Bandwagon, and that's when he said he didn't really like how the words information theory were being thrown around. So essentially what he was saying was that they were losing their value. Information theory as a concept was losing its value because companies were using it to describe things that didn't really fall within the umbrella of information theory.
Oh, yeah. It was a really popular and pop culture almost term in the scientific community at the time.
Yeah.
And I mean, people were publishing papers that had information theory in the title just because they thought it sounded cool when in fact, right, it had nothing to do with that.
So it was kind of like how virtual reality became this buzzword that began to lose meaning, mm-hmm. particularly when the public started to see what the reality of the field was as compared to the Hollywood depiction of what virtual reality was back in the early 90s.
Sure. Or like artificial intelligence.
Yep.
Or I read an essay recently from the guy who coined the term manic pixie dream girl, saying that he just wished he had never done that thing.
I would like to apologize to the world. So this was one of those interesting things where the paper wasn't so much about advancing the concept, but just saying, let's use our words carefully and correctly. He said that perhaps the term had, quote, ballooned to an importance beyond its actual accomplishments, end quote.
I think that's a little bit modest on his part, honestly.
I think so, too, considering that, again, without that theory, computers and electronics would not work the way they do today.
Yeah, but at any rate, this kind of marked the beginning of Shannon's disappearance from the research and technology scene. He really didn't want to be a celebrity, I think.
Yeah.
And he had this huge push from the media and the government and science in general to be made into one. And it kind of pulled him away from both research and public education.
Right. And it wasn't that he was cold. From what I understand, whenever he gave talks, they were really popular.
They were great. And whenever he wrote papers, they were really great.
But he was constantly being pressured to do that. And it was starting to become more of something that would cause him anxiety as opposed to something that he would enjoy doing. Well, in 1973, the Information Theory Society, which is part of the IEEE or IEEE, created an annual Shannon lecture that became the Shannon Award. And in 1978, Claude Shannon officially retired from MIT, although he had not really been actively working there for some years before
sure,
then.
Sure, certainly.
And in 1987, Claude Shannon gave his last interview to Omni magazine. Now, by the late 80s, Claude Shannon began to suffer from Alzheimer's and withdrew from the public eye entirely. His mm-hmm. wife would go and attend events instead in his place.
And in February 2001, at the age of 84, he would pass away.
Yes. There are some very inspiring and moving tributes to Claude Shannon that were published.
Yeah. Really beautiful things.
You can certainly go online and read a lot of those tributes that were written the week and month following his passing. And we have a collection of interesting little trivia that we didn't really want to fit into the overall episode, but were too entertaining to pass up.
It didn't really fit into the timeline, but so much of, I mean, if it wasn't charming enough, I mean, if charming is the correct word, actually charming is totally the correct word.
Yeah.
According to me, I find it downright charming that he wrote, papers that mathematically proved the computers can exist.
Yeah.
But, but other than that, there's just a lot of little just,
interesting
joy
minutia,
of life
yeah.
Moments.
So,
sure.
So one of those things is that, you know, we just said he was not big on pursuing the limelight. He didn't go after that at all. And often he would reluctantly take the stage. But, as time went on, he did that even less frequently. He wouldn't go out very much at all to address the public. And according to MIT Technology Review, he even had a file labeled Letters I've Procrastinated Too Long On.
Oh.
So if he got something from colleagues or government officials or scientific institutions and it had just been sitting around for a really long while, he would just put this in a file saying, well,
that's too late.
Yeah, and that's never going to happen. So I'm just going to put that in this file.
Oh.
He, like we said, loved to build stuff, to engineer stuff. You know, that whole telegraph line story is one of my favorites.
Mm-hmm.
Now, as a parent, he built a chairlift that would take his kids from his house to a nearby lake so they didn't have to walk the whole way to the lake. He also, from what I understand, designed a hidden panel in his office that didn't lead anywhere at all.
He just felt like building one.
He just needed it. It made me think of a Mitchell and Webb sketch where this wall must rotate, be both here and not here. Well, look, mate, that's a load-bearing wall. Yeah. But anyway, he just decided he wanted to make one. He also built a life-sized electric mouse named Theseus, after the Greek mythology figure. That's the one who was stuck in the labyrinth and had to find his way uh-huh. out, and the Minotaur or Minotaur, depending upon your preferred pronunciation, is after him. So this mouse, what it would do is it would explore a maze and quote-unquote remember where it had come from.
It was going after some little metal cheese bits, I think.
So the way this mouse would go through the maze is it would go down a pathway, and whenever the pathway would branch, it would start to rotate.
Right.
Yeah. So
it would take one, and then it could backtrack if it went down an incorrect route.
Right. And then it could take the path it had not taken, as opposed to, you know, if this were just an electronic mouse that had some collision detection, it could potentially just go back and forth down the same little pathway.
Forever, yeah, but this was branching.
This one knew, okay, well, I already took the path that's on the right, so I have to take the path that's on the left. So it was pretty cool that he built this thing. And, you know, just for the fun of it, he built it So,
also, probably my favorite robotic piece of his, a juggling robot.
Yeah.
A bounce juggling robot, to be precise.
A bounce juggling robot that looked like W.C. Fields, to be even more precise. Yeah, it was like having a, like, imagine a drum head, right? Mm-hmm. And the drum head allows things that are dropped on it, like a ball bearing, to be bounced on it. And then two little angled platforms that are serving as hands, mm-hmm, that are bouncing this, again, these three little balls.
Yeah.
And it just kept it going in a bounce juggling pattern perfectly.
And he basically made it out of, like, Erector set pieces.
Yeah, you know.
Just like you do.
And then he wrote a paper on the dynamics of keeping multiple objects in the air simultaneously.
It's pretty famous within the juggling community.
I tried to read it. I actually wrote How Juggling Works for HowStuffWorks.com. In fact, if you go to that article on How Stuff Works and you look up How Juggling Works, there's a video of me juggling in that article.
I still say it, because I juggle a little bit, I still say that we really need to do a video of us both juggling.
All right. I juggled torches in mine. You ready to pick those up?
No.
Okay. Well, we'll start small. He also made a robot that could solve a Rubik's Cube, mm-hmm, which is pretty amazing. I mean, obviously that needs...
I can't solve a Rubik's Cube.
Yeah, I can't either. I know there are algorithms for how to solve it the most efficiently. And I've seen people who are really good at it, who just...
Oh, yeah.
Like, it's like magic. You know, the way I solve a Rubik's Cube is by peeling the stickers off and then,
aww,
replacing them properly.
Aww.
Yeah, it's...
Uh-huh.
I cheat. But, he created a robot that could follow these algorithms and also just recognize what the pattern was on any given side so it could, you know, create the rules it needed to solve it. And he made a calculator that worked with Roman numerals. It was called Throwback, which stood for Thrifty Roman Numerical Backward-Looking Computer.
Also, rocket-powered frisbees and motorized pogo sticks.
Yes, the motorized pogo stick. I was thinking, like, again...
That sounds terrifying. That
would, if the unicycle hadn't killed me already, that certainly would. He built the ultimate machine. My favorite machine of all time is the ultimate machine.
All right, tell us about it, Jonathan.
All right, now imagine you have before you a box... And on that box, you can see the outline of a trap door. And the only other really interesting feature on this box is a simple switch that is switched to off. And you push the switch to on. The trap door opens, and a hand emerges from beneath the trap door and hits the switch back to the off position, withdraws back inside, and the trap door closes.
That's it.
That's it. You hit the switch, and the arm comes back out. You hit the switch, the arm comes back out. I want to share this video too. There's a video of a brilliant variation of the ultimate machine that is hysterically funny. It doesn't just do that. Like, it starts to do it. So, it ends up at first looking like it's a variation on the ultimate machine. You're like, oh, well, that's cute. But then it starts doing other things too, because this particular box had wheels on it and can move out of the way. So it's starting to avoid the person who's trying to hit the switch. Or it would play back pre-recorded messages saying, like, hey, hands off, buddy, that kind of stuff. And was really, really entertaining. So we'll share that one as well. But you have to remember that that particular very entertaining machine is based off this thing that Claude Shannon built for no reason other than it tickled him.
Just because he could. He also had a collection of exotic unicycles.
Including some that were, because he was wondering how small could you make a unicycle before someone would be unable to ride it. For me, that's any size, but
I think me too. That would be any size.
But assuming that you are capable of riding a unicycle, how small could you go before you could no longer maintain your balance? In fact, he had a couple that I've heard are essentially unrideable. He also lectured on using information theory as an application to playing the stock market, though he never really published any work on this. He did do a lecture, but he didn't write a paper. He also did really well in the stock market himself, although he wasn't necessarily employing information theory to do so. He was investing in companies that friends of his were behind.
Yeah, he made some very savvy stock purchases based on amazing work that his friends were doing.
Yeah, these are the people who were inventing, like, the basic components of computers and electronics, going on to form their own companies, and he would invest in those, and then they ended up being these enormous companies we know today.
Mm-hmm.
So he did quite well. And there's no Nobel Prize for mathematics, which is why Claude Shannon never won one.
Right. But he certainly did win a number. I mean, probably way too numerous to mention here, awards, but one that we wanted to mention
is the very first Kyoto Prize, which was created in Japan to award honors to contributions in mathematics. Essentially, it was supposed to be the Nobel Prize for mathematics.
Right. And this was all the way in the 1980s that this came into invention.
Yeah, the very first one went to Claude Shannon. And from what I understand, it actually came with an even larger cash prize than the Nobel Prize does. So,
wow.
So if you feel like he was snubbed because Nobel Prizes don't recognize mathematics, fear not, the Kyoto Prize had him covered.
I hope you guys enjoyed this classic episode, Who Was Claude Shannon?, published back in August of 2014. If you have suggestions for topics I should cover in future episodes of Tech Stuff, whether it's a technology, a trend, maybe it's another important person in the field of technology, and you feel like this person hasn't really, you know, received the full treatment that they should, let me know. Reach out to me. The best way to do that is over on Twitter. The handle for the show is TechStuffHSW. And I'll talk to you again really soon.
Tech Stuff is an iHeartRadio production. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
No surprise here, but you know I gotta have my devices when I travel. I would be lost without my smartphone. I use it for directions, to find things to do, and most importantly, where to eat. I rely on it as a digital music player to enhance my experience as I explore a new place. Oh, and sometimes I even use it to make calls and stuff. That's the kind of traveler I am. And if you travel, you know what kind you are, too. That's why you go with the Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card. If you travel, you know.
You're a growing business, which means you need every spare hour you can find. That's why the most successful growing businesses are working together in Slack. Slack is where work happens, with all your people, data, and information in one AI-powered place. Start a call instantly in huddles and ditch cumbersome calendar invites. Or build an automation with Workflow Builder to take routine tasks off your plate. No coding required. Grow your business in Slack. Visit slack.com to get started.
Diamonds Direct Spring Sale starts this weekend. Get 20% off rings, earrings, pendants, bracelets, and more. It's the best store-wide sale of the season. Plus, book an appointment and get an additional $100 off. That's 20% off plus $100 off store-wide. And enjoy an expanded selection of the latest styles with designer appearances each weekend. Tons of engagement rings on sale, too. 20% off starts Friday and opens Sundays. Details at DiamondsDirect.com.
You don't have to hop a plane to see the world. This month's Free This Week picks on Xfinity brings you around the globe. Experience life at a European resort in the hit comedic drama Seaside Hotel from Walter Presents. Watch romance blossom abroad in a Scottish love scheme from Hallmark Movies Channel. Celebrate Earth Month with planet-saving docuseries like Eco Eye with Duncan Stewart on Magellan TV. And be transported to your happy place with iHeartRadio's Feeling Good playlist. Just say Free This Week into your Xfinity voice remote.